Welcome to A Catra Dialogue, a journey through timeless literature. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of A Catra AI, and welcome to the deep dive. Today, our mission is to really immerse ourselves in just one incredible work of American literature, Ralph Ellison's 1952 masterpiece, Invisible Man.
Yeah, it's quite something.
It is. And it's amazing. It was the only novel Ellison actually completed in his lifetime. But it's this unmatched blend of a coming-of-age story, a Bildungsroman, sharp social critique, and modernist experimentation.
Absolutely monumental. And, you know, to really get the feel of the writing, you have to think about Ellison's own background. He was a trained musician.
Right.
And those jazz and blues rhythms, they're everywhere in the prose and the structure. It's crucial, too, that Ellison pushed back against the idea that Black literature had to be just simple social protest. He aimed for something much deeper, you know, exploring the whole psychological, existential maze of identity, the struggle to be yourself when society keeps trying to slap these racist labels on you.
That really sets up the whole journey, doesn't it? We're basically tracking the narrator as he painfully sheds one false identity after another. And it's all framed by that that central, unforgettable metaphor right from the opening line.
Exactly. The narrator, he doesn't even have a name. Tells us his whole existence is shaped by not being truly seen. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me.
And it's not like he's a ghost or something supernatural.
No, not at all. It's a social condition, a profound one. People see him, but only as a stereotype or, you know, a problem, maybe a symbol, never just as a unique person.
And the place he tells his story from is quite radical, too, this hidden underground room in New York City.
Yeah, that setting is the statement in itself. He's literally living beneath the surface, sort of embracing the darkness, but finding clarity there.
Mm.
And he lights this dark cellar. Well, it's almost obsessive.
With those light bulbs.
Yes. 1,369 light bulbs, all stolen, illegally wired in to the electric company's grid. It's not just, like, for decoration. It's symbolic. It's his demand for intense illumination, this absolute insistence on seeing clearly, and maybe being seen clearly, even if he has to steal the power from the very system that makes him invisible.
That desire for clarity, though, it starts from a place of, well, deep naivety down south, doesn't it? He actually believes in the system, in meritocracy, accommodation.
Oh, completely. But that illusion gets shattered, just brutally, right at the beginning.
The battle royal.
Mm-hmm. That scene. It's probably the most famous, most visceral metaphor for systemic cruelty in the entire book. The narrator, he's just a kid, really blindfolded along with other young Black men.
And they're forced to fight each other.
Right, for the entertainment of these prominent white men. And then, after they're beaten and bloody, they have to scramble for coins on this rug.
That's electrified.
An electrified rug, yeah.
It just hits you immediately, his complete lack of real agency. They're fighting each other, literally blindfolded, while the real power structure just sits back and watches, amused.
It sets the stage perfectly.
Mm.
Any reward you might get from this system, it comes drenched in humiliation and pain. And yet, he still gets up and gives his graduation speech, this sincere accommodationist speech, still believing in the power of polite words.
But the real betrayal, the more insidious kind, happens at his college, right? A prestigious Black college.
Yeah, his downfall there isn't some crime he commits. It's because he accidentally shows a white trustee, this Mr. Norton, a bit too much of the real South, the stuff the college president wants kept hidden.
Like the encounter with Jim Trueblood, the sharecropper,
mm-hmm.
and that chaotic scene at the Golden Day Bar with the veteran.
Exactly. And that brings us face to face with Dr. Bledsoe, the college president. He's a key figure. Represents a certain kind of compromised leadership, maybe.
He keeps his power by playing the game.
Absolutely. Through accommodation, he actively hides uncomfortable truths, even sacrifices his own students, really, to keep his own standing with the white power structure. He's a master manipulator. He sees the narrator not as a promising young man, but as a threat to his carefully built world.
And the calculation involved?
Yeah.
It's chilling. Bledsoe kicks him out, but pretends to help him, sending him north to New York with these sealed letters of recommendation.
Oh, those letters. They're just... They're masterpieces of deceit. They're actually letters of damnation.
Yeah.
They explicitly warn anyone reading them not to hire the narrator, painting him as dangerous, untrustworthy. Bledsoe even says something truly awful later on, like, I'll have every Negro in the country hanging if it means staying where I am.
Wow.
It just lays bare the kind of corrupt bargain sometimes needed to operate within these oppressive systems, even for someone ostensibly in power.
So he's been blinded, betrayed in the South. He heads north to Harlem, looking for, I guess, genuine opportunity, real clarity,
Right.
only to find a whole different kind of exploitation.
Right. He arrives full of hope, but those letters from Bledsoe slam every door shut.
Yeah.
Eventually, though, he gets a job at the Liberty Paints factory. And this is where the novel really shifts into high allegory.
The factory that makes optic white paint.
The purest white paint available. That's their slogan. If it's optic white, it's the right white. Something like that.
Okay. And this is like the big symbolic moment, right? The secret ingredient for this perfect white paint.
Yes. The narrator finds out, kind of accidentally, from this cynical older black worker, Lucius Brockway,
mm-hmm.
that to get that perfect, brilliant whiteness,
mm-hmm.
you absolutely must add a single drop of black chemical toner.
Wow. Just one drop.
Just one drop. Without it, the paint is dull, lifeless, sort of gray. The metaphor is just.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly powerful.
It hits you right between the eyes.
Yeah. What does it say about American society if its perceived purity, its whiteness, actually depends entirely on this essential but deliberately hidden black component? African-American labor, culture, identity. It's fundamental to the whole thing, yet constantly made invisible or denied.
That whole factory sequence ends pretty badly for him, too, with the explosion.
Right. The explosion. And then he ends up in the factory hospital. And the treatment he gets there, this sort of electroshock procedure, it feels like a symbolic lobotomy.
Like society trying to erase his memory, his identity.
Exactly. Trying to wipe the slate clean, make him controllable, conformist, get rid of that troublesome consciousness, as Elson might put it. It's like a symbolic death and rebirth, leaving him raw, detached from his past.
And it's after that experience that he starts searching for some kind of collective purpose, which leads him to the Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm. A political group very clearly modeled on the Communist Party USA of the time.
And at first, it seems like maybe this is the answer. Community, an ideology, a framework for fighting back.
It offers him a role, a voice, a structure. But pretty quickly, you realize it's just another kind of cage, another way of being defined by others, by an abstract ideology this time.
And the leader, Brother Jack, embodies this, right? With the glass eye.
Yeah, Brother Jack. That glass eye is such a potent symbol. It's not just a physical trait. It signals his ideological blindness. He literally can't or won't see people as individuals, especially the narrator or the Harlem community. They're just tools, instruments for achieving the Brotherhood's abstract political goals. Theory trumps humanity, always.
So the narrator finds himself caught between these two opposing forces, really. There's the Brotherhood's cold, abstract ideology.
And then there's the fiery, passionate black nationalism of Roz the Exhorter.
Right. Roz represents a completely different path.
Totally different. Roz, who later calls himself Roz the Destroyer, preaches immediate, often violent resistance. He rejects any collaboration with white people or institutions. He embodies that raw, legitimate anger and disillusionment in the community.
An anger the narrator understands even if he can't fully embrace Ross's path.
Exactly. The narrator recognizes the truth in Ross's fury, but he also sees the danger, the potential for self-destruction in that kind of separatism and violence. It's another impossible choice. Rigid ideology on one side, destructive rage on the other. Neither seems to allow for his full, complex humanity.
And this conflict, this disillusionment with the Brotherhood, it leads to one of the most tragic figures in the novel, Todd Clifton.
Oh, Clifton, yeah. He's this charismatic, really promising young black leader within the Brotherhood. But he just gets completely disillusioned with their rhetoric, their lack of connection to the real struggles on the street.
And his response is so heartbreaking. He quits the Brotherhood and ends up
selling these racist Sambo dolls on the street corner, these grotesque dancing paper dolls that play on the worst stereotypes. It's this deeply disturbing act of, what, public self-mockery? Internalized racism made into street theater? It's hard to watch.
It's like he's forcing people to see the strings, the manipulation, maybe.
Perhaps. It's an act of profound despair, really. Showing how the system reduces black men to puppets. And then tragically, he's shot and killed by a police officer during a confrontation while selling these dolls.
Which becomes a major turning point.
A huge catalyst. But it also leads to the narrator's final break with the Brotherhood. They don't see Clifton's death as a human tragedy or a political rallying point based on truth. They just criticize the narrator for organizing a massive, spontaneous funeral march without their official permission.
It's all about the party line again. Theory over life.
Precisely. And that cold, inhuman calculation is the last straw. It fuels the narrator's disillusionment and helps spark the Harlem riot.
The climax of the novel.
Yeah, a night of absolute chaos. Fires, looting confusion. Then Arya tries to navigate it, maybe even subvert it, but he just gets swept up. And in the middle of it all, he's hunted by Raz.
Raz the Destroyer now.
Right. Who appears almost like a mythical figure, dressed as an Abyssinian chieftain, riding a horse, carrying his spear, determined to kill the narrator for being a traitor to the race by working with the Brotherhood.
It's so surreal. And how does he escape?
He's running from Raz, running from the police, and he just falls. Falls into an open manhole, down into a coal cellar. And he chooses to stay there.
He chooses the darkness, the underground.
He does. And that descent isn't just an escape. It's the novel's resolution, in a way. Down there, in that dark underground space, he finally has the room to think, to take stock.
And he burns things.
Yes. He performs this sort of ritual cleansing. He takes out his old briefcase, filled with symbols of his past identities, and burns them one by one. The high school diploma, the Sambo doll he picked up from Clifton, those damning letters from Bledsoe.
Severing the ties.
Exactly. Symbolically cutting himself off from all the false identities imposed on him by Southern society, by industry, by political ideology. This underground isn't defeat, it's hibernation. It's necessary gestation for the self.
And this leads us to the epilogue, where he reflects on everything. He's finally shifted from looking outside for validation to defining himself. There's that amazing line.
Oh, yeah. I was looking for myself and asking everyone except myself questions, which I, and only I, could answer.
That's it. The whole journey summed up. He realizes the answers weren't out there in society's definitions. They had to come from within.
And that understanding allows him to pose that final, profound question from his illuminated underground room, right? He asks the reader, essentially, who knows but that on the lower frequencies I speak for you?
Mm-hmm. Suggesting that maybe truth, real understanding, operates beneath the surface, below the standard ways we communicate or see the world. His invisibility, his isolation, paradoxically becomes a way to connect, a form of testimony.
It transforms his specific condition into something potentially universal.
I think ultimately the novel teaches us that maybe the hardest, most important form of resistance isn't just fighting the obvious oppression, but insisting always on your own complex, individual, messy humanity, refusing to be flattened into a category.
Yeah, that struggle to be truly seen for who you are, not what society labels you, that feels like a fundamental human fight, maybe more relevant than ever today.
This conversation ends here. We'll meet again with another unique work of world literature. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.